Reverend Davis, Reel 2. You were just saying that this officer slowly fell forward.
Yes. And then the commanding officer had by now at his given the order that the remains of the battalion would commence withdrawal. He realized by now that all further hope of relief had gone. The men had fought in a marvelous, calm, stubborn bravery throughout. All that was done had been, all that could have been done was now done. Ammunition had literally gone. And so each company, the remains of each company, they were to attempt to break out of the Chinese encirclement as well as they could. And so they began to pour off that ridge in groups and disappearing into the deep undergrowth and into the gullies and hoping to make a run for it. Now, the battalion doctor had been told by Bob Hickey, who was later awarded an MC for his bravery throughout this, the adjutant had told Bob Hickey, our medical officer, that the withdrawal was to take place, and the colonel had had to say, "Bob, I'm afraid I have to tell you that we cannot carry the badly wounded with us. They must be left." Bob then said, "Well, I shall not be taking part in the withdrawal, sir. I feel it's my duty to remain with these wounded dying men." And quite independently of Bob at that time, the adjutant later on, much later on, told me about this, about Bob. In fact, we were prisoner of war months later. But quite independently, I was separated from Bob at this time, and I was attending to some other wounded chap who was not dying, just badly wounded. And I thought, too, whatever happens, it's my duty as chaplain, really, to stay with these few men who cannot move. I felt in my, just without any heroics, that it was my duty to remain with them as chaplain, to give what solace and that I could. Anyway, so all that remained, eventually, when most of the battalion had withdrawn, we were left alone. There was a doctor, myself, Sergeant Brisland, the medical sergeant, and about four other very good members of the medical staff. I think one private, one corporal, and myself, just about four or five of us. And I remember turning to the RMC Sergeant Brisland and saying, "This looks like a holiday in Peking for some of us." And I remember seeing Sergeant Major Sam Weller come down from his position with a few of his men taking part in the withdrawal. And I thought it was my last chance to say something to him as he went down with the rest of the troops trying to break out. He looked at me and shouted at me, probably saying, I didn't hear it fully. "You must come, it's time to go." And I called out to him, "Sam, tell the adjutant I'm staying with wounded," because I thought they might get out and some of us would be taken prisoner, but some of us would get home. Anyway, the next most amusing thing I remember at that time, Sergeant Brisland, he had a white flag with a red cross on it, and so he began to, because we expected at any minute, of course, to see the oncoming Chinese troops break over the last ridge and come down upon us. And Sergeant Brisland was waving his white flag with a red cross up for our protection for the wounded men in the mental aid post, such as it was, a few wounded men, the doctor, myself, and the medical staff. And Drum Major Buss, who was one of the last to go down, I clearly see him now coming from his position to join the, obviously got the catch from him somehow, to join the troops going down to try and break out. And I remember him stopping and looking, sort of waving this flag. You see him now with his moustache whistling on the deserted, now deserted weapon pit above us, and he clutching his rifle, he shouted to the audience, he started, "Put that bloody white flag down!" Final gesture of defiance. It was clear that the drummy, as we called him, hadn't fully appreciated what was happening. And hence his furious whistling, waving a sort of flag of surrender. But I shouted to drummy, "The battalion's gone, drum major. For heaven's sake, run for it, man. It's your only chance." He looked at me and then, still clutching his rifle, he disappeared down the slope. Drummy, yes. And then, just before the Chinese appeared, my last thing, which I must tell you, some yards above me, when I say above me, I mean above the scrape we made for the temporary medical aid post, such it was, a bit of a hole in the ground, I saw a young private soldier with the officers, a 19-year-old lad he was. I saw him lying dead on the edge of his weapon pit, and I could see the blood just welling from his mouth. I crawled up. We hadn't seen the Chinese at all at this time yet, but there was dead silence now. Big silence had fallen on the ridge. No more firing. I crawled up to that boy, and in his one of his hands, he still was clutching, you know, obviously a Roman Catholic boy, his rosary beads. And I removed those rosary beads from around, got them from around a couple of his fingers. And I also felt in his battle dress pocket, in case there were letters there. And sure enough, there was one letter still in his pocket. I took the beads and the letter, and the letter, as we always do in the army, I very quickly tore the letter up. We always do that, army letters. They can be lovely things, they can be perhaps harmful things to people. Tore the letter up and scattered the wind. But the rosary beads I stuffed in my pocket. And those rosary beads remained with me for 2.5 years of captivity. And on my return to England at the end of 53, I was able to return them to his parents. And then, as I was saying, there was a strange lull settled on the ridge, which had been a fury of noise and napalm and artillery fire and small arms fire. A strange lull had settled on that final ridge. And four or five able-bodied but very dazed Gloucester men stumbled into the aid post. They were not wounded, they were just completely sort of bewildered. They stumbled into the aid post. I remember my feeling at the time, probably, although I wasn't able to discuss it with him, I suppose our doctor felt the same. I felt just absolutely dazed, and I can't remember feeling afraid, really, that the stomach-turning spasms of fear which I'd had during the battle, which I suppose all normal people would have and so on, at times had gone. I just felt dazed and somehow not afraid. And I remember a sort of very weary sense of, I suppose you'd call it, nonchalance coming over me. I looked along the ridge to the deserted ground which had been held so bravely for the very last by the remains of A Company. I saw a solitary grenade burst there. Then there was silence again. And my thought was then, I just hoped that the Royal Artillery, 45 Field Regiment, far behind, had decided not to give a final shelling of covering fire over the ridge. I needed to worry because they'd have to retire to save the guns. But I thought if they were to fire now, final few volleys over the ridge, and it fell short, we'd be goners. I remember saying something to a man on a stretcher by my side, and he seemed remarkably calm and resigned too. He said, "Well, that's it, Padre. Let's see what happens next. And when he said that, I suppose about 4 or 5 minutes later, we saw the first Chinese troops came pouring over the ridge. The first and came over the lip of the hollow in which the aid post was situated. I remember them thinking right away, what small, extremely young-looking chaps they were. They were shabby, tattered, armed with new automatic weapons, and they're all chattering very excitedly. And of course, they covered us with their weapons and were shouting at us. We had no idea what they were shouting about, of course, but Bob, Hickey, and I and staff, we all immediately put our hands on our heads to show that we had no arms and that we couldn't fire them at all. And then, mercifully, a young Chinese officer finally made his appearance. He spoke a certain amount of broken English, and he made us all form up in file with our hands on our heads, and he was going to march us down to the base of Hill 327. We tried to demonstrate that we wanted to carry our several stretcher cases with us, but they wouldn't look any delay. A little later on, there was a South Korean interpreter also taken prisoner. That Chinese officer did tell us through the interpreter, he said, "No, you cannot bring these men down. Do not fear. The Chinese people's volunteers will bring your wounded men down later." And as far as I can judge, that was carried out. And later that afternoon, the Chinese deprived Bob of his remaining instruments and medical kit. And we just lay exhausted at the side of a stream that flowed, a small river that flowed through the area where we were. And the Chinese guards, to do them justice, they did throw us a tin of bully beef from our captured supply trucks, and a couple of loaves of bread. And they also brought us in a bucket some water from the stream. We'd been told not to drink water, of course, without boiling, but we drank that water and still alive today. That was our first food and drink, apart from one or two biscuits in nearly 48 hours. So we were absolutely exhausted physically and mentally, and we just lay there in that gully. About 3:30, that afternoon, to our horror, we saw the Chinese guards bringing in several hundred of the monster prisoners who had been taken. And the attempt to break out had failed, of course. Colonel Tom had been able to make a further break for it with sergeant major and a couple of other men. He was at large for a bit longer, but eventually rounded up too. But the rest of the battalion were brought in, and it was very discouraging to see this, that all the gallant bids at a breakthrough had for the most part failed. In the end, one officer, Captain Mike Harvey, and about 30 of his men got through back to the United Nations lines. Mike Harvey was well known in the battalion as an absolute black badge judo expert. So obviously a man of great skill and sense of judgment too, probably. Mike deliberately led his men north towards the river. He didn't break out south because he worked out in his head that probably the bulk of the Chinese troops had come now, were coming south. He reckoned if he could make his way with his surviving men of his company in a northward direction towards the Indian River, there might be more chance. And strangely enough, he brought that off. He had, in the end, couldn't stop the badly wounded men. Of course, they attempted to get back with the survivors. He was able to bring out himself and 30 men. They hit near disaster when they emerged from some scrub and undergrowth to realize across about 200 yards away on open ground, was an American tank, which spotted them and began to fire a salvo. It was by the greatest good fortune that they were able to signal and stop the firing and make the Americans realize these were British troops who escaped. So they were nearly done for, but they made it. Mike Harvey later became a brigadier and did very well, and of course he got to meet the NC for that, bringing those men out in that way. They were going to survive it in the battle. The rest of us, that night, when over 300 of us crossed both shallows of the Indian River in bright moonlight, carrying wounded on stretchers and helping the wounded wounded. Nightmare crossing, of course, stripped except for our shirts rolled up to our armpits and holding the rest of our stuff on our heads, keeping our boots on because of the sharp stones in the shallow river crossing. And, you know, I can recall that scene, an absolute torrent of Chinese troops, baggage carriers, mules, gun carriages pouring across, a tremendous uproar of sound as we, to the left of them, were making our precarious way through the shadows to the next bank as prisoners of war. And as we got well into that chilly water, Tony Farrah Hockley, who was on the front, he with me was the two front men on a stretcher. And as we got into the water, he said to me, I'm calling up somebody from behind to take my place in the front pole with you, Padre. He said, I'm in a few minutes going. He said, I've got to get back somehow and let everybody know what's happened. He said, I'm going down the river. And when he'd been relieved, he'd gone like a dream, away in the darkness, like a fish borne rapidly downstream. And one could only pray for his good success. The rest of us made the other bank, shivering with cold and hastily dressed, guards shouting at us and prodding us with their rifle butts. And so we marched on under guard, in heavy sodden boots, until near dawn, throats and lips sore with thirst, absolute fatigue to breaking point. Stretchers were a terrible liability, of course. Some men gallantly did far more than their share of the carrying, I think. And that was the beginning of our captivity. Of course, Tony Farrah Hockley was on the run for, this was April the 25th, 1951. He was on the run for a month or two, as you probably know, trying to get back, never made it. And eventually, he caught up. He was brought back by the guards with terribly lacerated feet and in a very poor condition, brought back to us to rejoin the march north. I well remember the first address we had from some Chinese officer. We all lined up at midnight, the second night of March, probably on the edge of a paddy field, I think. And I can well remember the words which were shouted at us by, I presume, a Chinese political officer in Americanized English, which was not a Turkish English, of course, you know. Which was easy to understand, and this is what he said to us. Officers and soldiers of the British Army, you are now prisoners of the Chinese People's Volunteer Forces in Korea. You have been duped by the American imperialists. You are tools of the reactionary warmongers. You are fighting against the righteous cause of the Korean people, supported by their brothers, the Chinese people. You are hirelings of the barbarous Syngman-Rhee puppet government. But you will be given the chance to learn the truth through study and correct your mistakes. Do not be afraid. We shall not harm you. At home, your loved ones await you. Obey our rules and regulations. Then you will not be shot. That speech is really imprinted on my memory. And that speech, of course, sounded the keynote of the celebrated Chinese lenient policy towards war prisoners. We were dupes, tools, even war criminals, enemies of people, but the lenient policy was to preserve our lives so that we could learn the truth. Later, we were often addressed as fellow students, that is, of Marxism-Leninism. So that was the beginning of 2.5 years of captivity.
What about the trek northwards to your camp?
A very long, tiring march. Remember, the incidents I've just been telling you took place between April the 21st and April the 27th or 8th. We didn't get to our final camp at Bing Chong Ni until early November of that year. So it was a long, drawn-out march with many halts in desolate villages in North Korea. And sometimes our route would take us south again for a day or two, and we'd think perhaps we're going to be handed over. Then it would veer north again. So a long march of hundreds of miles. And I personally congratulated myself for having taken very seriously to heart our regimental quartermaster's advice about 10 days before the Indian battle really broke. He said, those whose boots are beginning to get a bit worn, report at a certain time to rear headquarters and will be issued with brand new army boots. Now, some of the chaps whose boots are a bit worn didn't bother him. They were well, worth fussing about. And mine were a bit worn, not too. However, I went, I thought, well, you never know. I went and had just broken nicely in and dubbing my new army boots. And thank God I did that, because they laughed at me throughout that terrible march. And right through the whole of the captivity until release. So I felt then, I would always warn young soldiers, if I speak before combat, if you get a chance of renewing your boots, and the quartermaster tells you before some break, make sure your boots are in great condition.
Did you see much of Korean civilians on the way?
Yes, quite a few. And sometimes, as we went to the Indian River for crossing, by the way, one saw the terrible sight of young Korean mothers sometimes clutching babies lying in the minefields. They'd accidentally gone into minefields, of course, been blown dead, you know, or caught in the heat of battle. And that's a terrible sight. One has some of these young Korean women touching little babies, prone dead, of course, in the battlefield or the minefield. And on the march, we would be halted in Korean villages, and we'd have the opportunity of seeing Korean villagers, who viewed us, of course, with great suspicion and the apprehension that the last thing they would want would be to be seen in any way comforting us or talking to us Chinese guards. And of course, I suppose in their indoctrination, they've been told that these are the people who bombed your homes, and they're responsible for all this horror you're going through. So their feelings towards us would not have been very helpful. But I remember Major Harding, who I told you died in April just recently, and whose funeral he became colonel, of course, full colonel. I remember him telling me that on the March 4th, on one occasion, he was sitting outside a place, some hut where there was a Korean peasant, who would come out and looking to left and right, without saying anything to him, with a stick, he traced in the dust a large cross and looked at Dennis Harding, nodded his head. Nothing was said. And I remember Dennis telling me that, and then he with his foot, he rubbed it out and went off into this little hut. But it's rather lovely recollection, because of course before the North Korean invasion, the Christian faith was firmly established in North Korea, Roman Catholic and Anglican and Methodist too. All those people, of course, fled before the invasion into South Korea, building up the nominal population enormously. And as you probably know, under the rule of Kim Il Sung in North Korea. He died recently. Under his rule, no outward expression of religious observance was allowed at all, or no churches at all, and religion was a very suspect activity. But we know now that there were quiet, small house churches going on, where little groups of Christians would meet just to say a few prayers and read the New Testament together. We know that went on, and we know that probably out of a population in North Korea of some perhaps 25 million, compared with South Korea's 45 million, we know that we believe there was about something like about 8,000 privately professing Christians of several denominations left. This became apparent when things began to fall a bit in the last 2 or 3 years. However, I could tell you so much, bore you for hours and hours, of course it's all down in my book, as you know, in Spine of Dungeons, but picking out some thoughts of the march north and the interrogations one went through by the Chinese, groups of us were taken away and individuals taken away, including myself, for interrogation by the Chinese interrogators and the interpreters. I'll just tell you this, that I was handed a long card bearing the names of various army ranks from general downwards in English and equivalent Chinese script. And in my interrogation, which took place about 2 o'clock in the morning, I remember, the village where we halted, I was told to put my finger on my rank and function. Of course, I saw captain, but nowhere chaplain, and transport officer, engineer, artillery, nothing resembling the office of the chaplain. So, sitting in front of my interrogators in this candlelit cave, I put my hands together, raised my eyes to heaven, made a large sign of the cross on my breast, hoping that this would signify what I was. And I said to the interpreter, I am a chaplain, a priest, a religious man, Christian teacher. I remember the idea didn't really seem to sink in, and the interrogator began to speak very sharply to me in Chinese, and the young interpreter said to her, but you are a captain. I still have my 3 tips, because chaplains there, military rank in the army, you know, still have my 3 captain's tips on my battle dress. You are a captain, yes, but I am a Christian priest, a religious leader in the army. You are a captain. You are with Commander Carney. What is your job? And so it went on. And it was very, it was impossible really to get through. Why you come to Korea? Because the United Nations believe North Korea invaded South Korea. That's why we came. But do you know that on July the 25th, South Korea invaded North Korea? Invaded by the Wall Street warmongers and the Anglo-American imperialist bloc. Why you come to help this unjust war against Korean people? So you could make no progress there. How many outfits in British Brigade? How about artillery?